Good morning and happy April Fool's Day. My name is Michael McCusker. The conjunction between April Fool's Day and National Vietnam Veterans Day this past Monday, March 29th, seems an irresistibly and instantly ridiculous, bogus sop of a tribute to Vietnam vets. The sort of thanks for your service drivel that resounds as artificially autonomous as let's do lunch. An exception to my personal scorn was a phone call from Massachusetts on Viet Vets Day that was about a close friend in Vietnam I had not heard about since rotating back stateside halfway through his war tour. His name is Fred Speckles, and he was a USMC combat photographer. During the latter part of 1966 and early 1967, he and I were often a reporter-photographer team, marauding through jungles and paddies with USMC infantry and often recon. The man who called told me Speckles was in a coma after suffering two strokes. The man who called is a post-Vietnam vet who spent some time in the Korean DMZ and is related to Speckles by marriage. He had recently seen old photos Speckles had taken in Vietnam. A few were of me identified by name. My caller triggered an internet search and tracked me down. He is a veterans advocate working to get every American veteran attention and coverage by the VA. In particular, Vietnam veterans whom he knows were dealt with badly, as though we were at fault for the war's humiliating loss. Though he might not be in full accord with my opinion, I dedicate this program to Fred Speckles. I have read the following on this program before. I call it Back Home in the USA, and I wrote it. All through his childhood, he lived in apprehension he would be caught up in a war, and his sense of its inevitability resulted in a belief that he would most likely, most certainly, be killed. He had much precedent to feed his premonition. He was born a few months before Pearl Harbor, a fat, happy American baby, unaware that hundreds of thousands of babies and children were being killed and crippled all over the world. Afterwards, the interminable years of a Cold War that threatened worldwide nuclear obliteration while he was growing up. Duck and cover was the dire mantra of his childhood. So when there was a war in Vietnam, he accepted it as the war of his generation. He inevitably volunteered for it as a U.S. Marine. Consumed with the pervasive self-prophecy of doom, he knew his short life was rooted on its inevitability. So he went to war, and to his immense surprise, survived without harm. And as utterly as the conjecture of war preoccupied the early part of his life, its stark reality structured everything afterward. He would never understand why he had lived through his one-year combat tour any more than he would grasp why persons near him were shot dead or blown apart somewhat further away by mortars or landmines. Yet he was never hit. Fresh from Vietnam, he cherished every day as unexpected and undeserved. That sharp sense of exhilaration, coupled with sorrow for dead friends and guilt for having survived when they did not, especially since he had been so sure he would not, had dulled over the decades. Yet he rarely took for granted he would be alive at the end of every day he awakened. He balanced somewhat paradoxically his appreciation that he continued to live with increased awareness of having used up his 70. Each day was a rebirth, but also a day closer to the crypt. His spool was running out faster the less time remaining to unravel. Now, when he glimpsed into the future, his attention was concentrated on his corpse sprawled somewhere up on the near timeline. For him, Vietnam was the war. Of all the wars, it had been the war he was in. Only for a year, but it beamed through his brain afterward with the clarity of a laser, surrounded by the rest of his years, which were muddled in comparative amnesia. He found it difficult to see through the bloody prism of the war to his earlier life. He saw an estranged apparition moving opaquely through a dimly remembered history he knew was his own, yet was discontinuous with the person who emerged from the war. The war was his fault line, and the parts it bifurcated did not quite match up. He felt the portion of him on the opposite side of the margin would not have much to say he would now be interested in. Vietnam, the war, as distinguished from the country, its history, and its culture, was always immediate in his mind, despite its disappearance into the shadows of collective memory. The war was as distant to the young generations born afterward as the myths of Armageddon. Vietnam veterans were grandparents and generally close-mouthed about the war with their families and friends who had not been in Vietnam. Among themselves, they chattered like crows. Even if they seldom mentioned the war, it was their connective tissue against the rest of the world. He realized each carried the war like personal armor. Other wars appear and pass, generally dwarfing their predecessors in their rapid surge, sluicing away the immediacy of each. War veterans seemed like old ghosts, unable to separate themselves from their vanished separate wars. He knew people were disappointed with Vietnam vets, not so much because the war was lost, but because it had undone so many of them. He thought his life after Vietnam had taken on the quality of an unsettled dream he might have had while he was still there, a displacement of what the war had shown him to be serious and real, but was of little use since. The paradox of surviving the war was that, obsessed by the war, he found it difficult to accept seriously the daily life he had lived since. More times than he could count, he was asked how he was able to make the transition from war to reality. The real question was how to make his post-war life real, that even after half a century, his life was still not real to him. The war was his real life. Everything else felt counterfeit. Back from the war, he discovered his reflexes had outlasted their necessity, as though everything afterward were an illusion. He flinched and nearly dropped to his belly when cars or trucks backfired or firecrackers erupted. Once, he threw a woman companion down on a sidewalk when his foot brushed against something he mistook for a booby trap tripwire. He might walk on a spring day in an open field admiring budding trees and smelling flowers. A moment later, a helicopter might fly over, and he would be instantly back in the war, looking intently for armed enemies among trees and bushes. He was angry and anguished by his close experience with death and horror for a year, a much shorter period of time than others at their various wars, but excessively more than enough for him. Others saw more combat, and he felt lucky the worst of it escaped him. Yet the war was iridescently the most vivid and climactic part of his life. It sculpted his attitude toward life and people, and he knew the essential dividing line between him and them. Those who experienced war, however lightly, and those who hadn't. He learned more about the reality of human relations in war than he probably would any other way. And though he had experienced scant combat compared to many others, he wished for no more of it. Everyone he knew in Vietnam had their own private, intensely personal war. And if they survived, they won the war, even though the larger war was lost. Vietnam was the nucleus of his life, as if both his birth and death were outer rings of less consequence. One sunset in a sky baroque with operatic clouds, a beam of memory sliced through him like a laser, a desperate pitched ball of hope sent into the future for him to catch by a very scared, much younger him, preparing for another long night in Viet Cong jungles and rice fields. projecting a beam of fervent desire that he would survive the night and all other nights he was in the war and be alive to receive the sharp ray from the past, which at that moment transmuted time and momentarily connected the bifurcated parts of him. The war was an open wound, not because his experiences were so terrible, but the terror he helped inflict upon Vietnamese. While many veterans did what they could to ease their memories through drugs and drink, he used them as a means to remember the war without going too crazy. He wished to be a conscience because he thought someone must. Somewhat like a guilt-stricken American soldier he had heard about, who wandered Hiroshima's radioactive streets, atoning for the atom bomb. He knew his feelings had no place in opulent, frenzied America, except among a few. But he was unable to change because he wouldn't allow himself to change. He seemed frozen in a moment long past, a war of a previous century and millennium. But for him, unresolved, despite the acceleration past remorse and shame by the society that perpetrated the war as a caustic matter of policy. He refused to allow the victims of the war, American and Vietnamese, Laotian, Cambodian, etc., to disappear into memory's dustbin. Some might have said he never recovered from the war, but the recovery they meant would have him stop thinking about the murder of Vietnamese, and he refused to recover from that. He would never forget he had helped define genocide to Vietnamese. It was his shining contrary icon, and now it seemed more important than ever to shine that crippled beacon among those who conceived similar genocides, in particular a millennial insanity that seemed to unravel on a global scale. He remembered his very small part of the war as a series of contradictory fragments, flashbacks of exhilaration, horror, and incessant dread that not only permeated his body and being, but which also became his accustomed companion to such a degree he was virtually unconscious of it. The war taught him to live in the moment, which he still did, though perhaps not as ardently as when he measured his life in seconds, at the most minutes. He had lived in the now, aware the next instant he might be dead, wounded, or inexplicably unscathed until the next shot or explosion. His war reached no farther than the narrow butchery of a daily routine of annihilation. Then his time was up and he was out of the war. A ship's voyage back to the States and discharge. He often thought it strange to return from a war that was not over, would in fact continue for many more years. He had hoped to survive with his entire being, yet in memory he was always going back to the war, although behind everything was the knowledge that his war memories ended with his survival. The war was his moment, and it was gone. Or more truthfully, he was gone from it. It might have been best if he had not left it, or like so many vets, among them friends, opted out afterward rather than endure a dissembled, incomplete, and desolate continuance. Sometimes he felt the substance of himself died in Vietnam. Only a skeletal facade remained. He sleeplessly dreamed he was perpetually stuck in Vietnam. His real experiences were in his waking thoughts, triggered by noises, smells, sudden movements. His dreams were delusional, time loops of inescapable horridness, trapped at war over and over again. He felt that a large crowd of dead young men waited for his return to their company. Even half a century later, he knew he would not escape the war. It waited in ambush to finally booby-trap and kill him. Emotions he froze to survive reappeared when the horror was past, and in relative safety afterward, he involuntarily relived terrors he had suppressed the frantic moments they would have destroyed him if he had allowed them to form. Yet he savored living despite his estimation he was one of the walking dead. His definition of success was breathing. He lived one pointless day to the next, not at all worried that there was probably no real meaning to anything. He was satisfied that he was alive in the world and that he was brain and flesh to think and feel. He knew he was fortunate that he was not killed or crippled in Vietnam. He thought often of friends who were killed and wondered what had become of others who lived, what their post-Vietnam lives have been like, how many died in the intervening years. He was an old man remembering a young man's intensity of impending death, incoming at any moment, knowing the bitter truths and deceits behind his revulsion for the war, and most importantly, knowing who his real victims were, innocents killed, raped, crippled, tortured for no greater reason than they were there, in itself grotesquely sinister. He felt outside. He had experienced that which most people did not wish to speak about or be informed about, however much they publicly glorified it. The facts of his life were of little context, and the profundity of what he had learned was of no interest to those whose lives flowed daily around his own. Underlying everything else, he knew with certainty that he should never have gone to Vietnam. He had no right to participate in the killing of other human beings. When he thought or talked about war, he was not concerned with geopolitical aspects, but with the persons directly involved, as he had once been, the ciphers of little meaning or consequence to any but themselves and the few close to them. For him, the consequences were personal. The killers and the killed, the shattered lives of ordinary persons, destroying each other in the grips of forces they were unable to ignore or mediate, even between themselves. He felt that his survival of the war only set him up for a huge cosmic joke, but perhaps his survival was the joke. He felt conflicting feelings of happiness at being home alive and upset at the diffidence and resentment with which he was greeted by others who had not gone to Vietnam. Like a cop at a party, as a Vietnam vet, he was regarded with hostile embarrassment. During the many long years the war dragged on after his return from Vietnam, he felt he narrowly skirted mental breakdown because he knew that every day the war continued, Americans and Vietnamese were dying, and each day he and others urgently spent attempting to stop the war, they were rebuffed by a stone wall of disapproval and malignant patriotism. Patience was the shibboleth of both those for and against the war, whose concerns were more about the outcome than the costs. More than once, he wished to opt out, to disappear, but the only alternative was eventual suicide, and he didn't want to go there. Too many of his friends, who had fought so desperately to live through the war, surrendered to suicide once back home because of a combination of mental and moral breakdown that affected most who survived the war to various degrees. He saw a shrink a few times. The shrink thought the war was behind his psychic pain. Of course it was. If you don't come back from a war crazy, you're really crazy, he said. He wondered if the shrink's purpose was to soften reality for his patients or help them regain strength to struggle with it. Fighting through his despair would not involve rehabilitation, but rebellion. He wished to live quietly in a noisy world. He was in no hurry while virtually everyone around him skittered in high gear. His culture raced past like a rabbit. He shuffled rather than sprinted, reluctant to surrender the past, wishing he could bore into it like a worm into a womb. He was not rash enough to fling himself off a bridge or shoot off the top of his head. He preferred a slower suicide, erosion of spirit and purpose. His fierce opposition to the war was partly justification for quitting it when he had the chance, instead of extending for a second tour. He had used up his luck and was certain a second tour would be fatal. He had given the war and the USMC ample opportunity to kill or cripple him. He might feel survivor guilt, deserting friends who would remain in Vietnam. Obvious proof of his not doing enough was his survival, but he was not a fool, nor were most of his friends who rudely congratulated him for his good luck of survival with fervent expressed hopes of reaching their own deliverance dates. Yet he had been sickened at what he had helped bring upon Vietnamese and the cynical cruelty that impelled it. It did not take much persuasion for him to become an anti-war activist, and he believed he would have been even if Vietnam Veterans Against the War had not existed. He felt a deep responsibility for his involvement in the war, despite the urging of stateside friends to put it aside and move on with his life. He had participated in something regarded as dreadfully wrong and wished to make amends in some useful manner. It seemed to be to those like him to attempt undoing what they had done, even if they had had no choice, because he knew he had a choice, even if it meant disgrace or death. There it was. You ride history, or it rides you. He had turned irrevocably against the Vietnam War, but even his stance for peace was grim and warlike, and his experience against the war was for the most part violent, though he was generally on the receiving end of the violence perpetrated by police and National Guard units. He got beat up by cops, maced, tear gassed, and arrested all around the country while organizing veterans and participating in anti-war demonstrations. At first, he had believed people would ultimately listen to the soldiers who fought the war rather than the incessant propaganda by the stay-at-home war hawks. He was wrong. He and the other combatants who publicly turned against the war were denounced as traitors, worse than hippies and draft resistors, even as cowards. More sympathetic persons said to him, "You can't stop war." He replied, "It stops with me." He might also say, "A majority begins with one." He wondered if anyone would form groups of reenactors for Vietnam as they had for the Revolution, Civil War, and World War II. How would they restage the abrupt and usually brief firefights? He once half-jokingly suggested to a friend, also a Vietnam veteran, that they go back to Vietnam and be reenactors, paid like mercenaries to portray imperialist ugly Americans shot and killed every day in mock battles by heroic NVA or NLF soldiers, better yet, by women Viet Cong. He almost laughingly thought the only place in the world he might feel safe was Vietnam. A Vietnamese woman whose entry into the USA had been marriage to an American diplomat at the Saigon embassy asked him to concisely define his war experience in Vietnam. "Rambo and Goldilocks," he replied. He said he assaulted countless villages with other Marines, deja vu villages he called them. Most of the time, villagers fled at their entrance, while other Marines searched the villages for incriminating evidence of Viet Cong activity. He explored inside the mud and straw-thatched huts for whatever meals had been hastily abandoned on tables. He carried a USMC-issued spoon and a pair of bamboo chopsticks wherever he went to sample the orphaned food. A young girl once asked him if he was scared in Vietnam. He said he was terrified in his first firefight and wanted to run away, and that it never changed. His first thought every time was to run away. His greater fear was that if he did run, the Viet Cong would most likely be where he ran to. He had been so scared in Vietnam, he said, that he half wished to die so as not to be afraid anymore. His mother had told him before he left for Vietnam that the only war crime that would cause her to disown him as her son would be using his position as an armed soldier to rape a woman or a girl, a threat she had never made before. He followed her admonition and afterward told her and friends that he had not adhered to military codes of conduct, various Geneva Accords, Nuremberg mandates, or any of the other rules of war doctrines. He obeyed his mother's law. His father's influence was more ironic. His father had been 4F during World War II, and while growing up, he felt his father's presence as an outsider among war veterans. Many Marines he knew in Vietnam were there because their fathers had fought across the Pacific against Japan. He was there because his father had not been with their fathers. Now, half a century later, his war was lost in a fog of public amnesia and buried in the rubble of a dead millennium, alive only in the shadow of memories of his dwindling survivors, themselves vanishing into the sardonic dustbin of history. The clamor after 9/11 for patriotic unity gave him a sense of grim satisfaction rather than camaraderie. He no longer felt like a pariah. Friends didn't suggest he forget about Vietnam as they used to. Instead, they coyly asked what war was like and mockishly thanked him for his service, to which he generally responded that Vietnamese would not thank him. A succession of newer wars convulsed the country since 9/11. He wished he could stop them, stop the young who would kill and die before they had much of a chance to explore the new century. He thought he and other old vets obsessed with their past wars should take the places of the young men and women and finally die in the combat they had initially survived, but which had deadened them. Why not save the young and finally do something long postponed? He knew that was unreal, that he would never go to war again, only grieve for those who would. He remembered that just before he boarded ship for Vietnam, a World War II Marine he had known most of his life and thought him a fool for volunteering for the war, tried to tell him how to stay alive. He felt there wasn't much he could say to the fresh recruits for slaughter, and nothing he would have to say to the survivors afterward. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer for this program. Pledging for KMUN is no April Fool's errand. Supporting KMUN is instead spring reseeding of a beloved garden of sound and soul. A real April's Fool is one who does not wear a mask, lock down, or vaccinate during this deadly infectious time when only a breath separates life from death, especially when the plague is coming at all of us in a fourth wave of malignant holocaust. So don't be April Fools. Remember, protecting yourself protects everyone else. Happy April Fool's Day. As former legendary Portland Mayor Bud Clark would heartily say, whoop, whoop.